The Guardian.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in a new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up this week, crime and punishment. The Tories go back to basics in their bid to close the gap on Labour. And they've been helped out by an improving economy now officially out of recession.
Every bit of good news sends that team into a complete decline. But I can tell him the good news will keep coming.
Reality as drama. As Sir George Young bicycles back into the cabinet, we hear from the writer of This House, a tale of backroom Westminster intrigue in the 1970s, which is currently taking the National Theatre by storm. We'll ask, what does it take to be a chief whip? Plus, should the government really have decided to keep those lobbying letters from Prince Charles a secret? All of this to come with our top panel, Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee, social affairs editor Randeep Ramesh, and the director of the Centre for Crime and Justice Studies, Richard Garside. A warm welcome to you all. Back in 2006, a fresh-faced new leader of the Conservative opposition gave a major speech on crime. He said, "We have to think about the emotional quality of the work we do with young people. It's about emotional security. It is about love." Fast forward 6 years, take a few points off his party in the polls and throw in a battering from the right-wing press, and we emerge with a somewhat blunter approach this week.
Retribution is not a dirty word. It is important to society that the revulsion we all feel against crime is properly recognised and acted on by the state on our behalf.
So, Richard Garside, you follow these criminal debates forensically. On the face of it, that sounded like rather a lot had changed.
I think the thing to bear in mind is if you go back to the 2006 speech, Cameron essentially had two messages. He had a message which was about, for those young people who, as it were, live within the boundaries, we need to have love and nurture. For those who step across the pale, and I think he used the term step into the territory, the pale territory, or the territory of the pale, or something like that, he said they should expect painful consequences. And that kind of tension really between love and pain, which is partly about the notion of kind of those who play by the rules and those who don't and what they can expect, was there in the 2006 speech, and I think we saw it again the other day.
Polly, you dedicated your column this week to this big speech. Was it a significant change, or do you see continuity as Richard does?
I see dreadful continuity with all politicians in a hole. It's the last refuge of scoundrels and prime ministers in trouble. Blair did it all the time. When things are going really badly, you say, quick, bring me an eye-catching crime initiative. And there we were again in that same zone. I mean, actually, there was nothing very new to announce. Most of it had either been announced before or isn't going to happen. And it's just very depressing that they think it helps them. I don't think there's any clear evidence that it does. I mean, politicians have to be seen to be firm on crime, but I don't think they get a bounce in the polls when they say something tough.
And Randy, the background, of course, is that we've had roughly the doubling of the prison population in 20 years, and for nearly all of that time, we've had crime coming down. Indeed, we saw more of that this week. What do you make of the speech?
Well, I suppose the question is, are they related? Are they causal?
Yeah.
I don't probably think so. I think the jury's out on those things. There's lots of things that make crime go down, economic prosperity, whether goods
can be... much of that until today.
Well, until 2008. I mean, I'm talking from the mid-90s.
Yeah.
This crime has fallen. Whether you can nick things as easy as you once could, whether policing has got smarter. I don't think it's all to do on the punitive side of the equation. Cameron, to me, just sounded like someone who's speaking to the right wing of his own party. Blair, if you remember, used to do this similar sort of trick, you know, have a speech which was both lock them up and let them out. And that's kind of where Cameron came. I thought the best line in his speech was where he said, "We appear to be going both backwards and forwards, but never moving the debate on," which seems to be the quandary of all politicians.
There was interesting research from the Home Office. I'd like to ask Richard about this, which said that if you lock up 20% more people, which is phenomenally expensive, you think that each one costs £40,000, it does reduce crime by 4%. So it's a pretty bad return on your money compared to how else you might spend that amount of money on preventing it in the first place. Do you think that sound right to you, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really difficult to seek to prove the effect of imprisonment on crime. I mean, I think it's...
But Richard, there must be an effect, mustn't there? Because the people who are in prison aren't committing crime outside of prison while they're in there.
I think, you know, if you simply had nobody in prison and you closed down all prisons tomorrow, is that likely to have some kind of impact on the crime rate? It strikes me as likely it would do. But we're really talking about diminishing returns here, and I think that's always worth bearing in mind. And of course, there's all sorts of other things, factors that can have an impact. Policing, for example, detection rates. But of course, fundamentally, much more broader social factors. You know, there is a reason why when I'm going home this evening, I'm unlikely to mug my fellow commuters for their iPhones. And that's not because I'm necessarily a morally upstanding individual who fears prosecution in the prison. It's because actually I'm comfortably off and I don't need to engage in those kinds of activities. That's worth bearing in mind as well. But the other thing that's also, I think, interesting is if we look at the United Kingdom as a whole, the prison population in the United Kingdom has been falling by, on average, 9 a day since the end of March this year, falling by 9 a day. Now, there are reasons for that. I'd be fascinated in what they are. I think probably it's partly to do with the bulge from the riots and people now coming out of prison post-riots. But we've seen a rapid decline in the prison population. If that continued for the next 13 or 15 years, which I suspect it won't, we would have half the prison population that we currently have. So there are some interesting things going on the stats at the moment, which are worth bearing in mind.
Cameron didn't make much of the crime fall. Is that because he suspects, given recession lingers, despite what the figures might say, that he expects crime to rise? Because acquisitive crime tends to rise with a recession, right? I mean,
again, these things are very, you know, very complicated. And I mean, one of the things I've often said on this is actually just talking about crime rising and falling per se, I don't think is very helpful. We need to talk about types of crime, homicides, for example, or burglary, or particular types of acquisitive crimes. And you can start talking about those and you can see certain correlations, but there is no straight line correlation. I think the best that we can say is that social changes and social factors have an effect, but it's often a lag effect, as indeed to criminal justice changes. But there's a kind of a degree of complexity there which gets in the way, I think, of any simple correlations.
But we do know, don't we, that what politicians say affects what judges do. So, I mean, this may be that Ken Clark was, you know, used to be a bit more emollient, so the prison numbers came down. But ever since Michael Howard's great Prison Works, again, the Home Office Research Department used to have a graph that showed how prison population rose in relation to what politicians said. And, of course, Labour was dreadful on this. John Reid, Blunkett, Jack Straw, all up bidding each other to be tougher, and up, up, up went the prison population. Do you think this is the Ken Clark effect, that it's coming down a bit?
I actually don't think so. I suppose you could say that, I think the interesting question is, have there been particular changes in sentencing, for example, particular policy changes, for example, changes in the way that people are remanded in custody, how foreign national prisoners are dealt with, whether there's been a possible impact, certainly in terms of the youth custodial provision, which has significantly dropped in recent years. A number of those things, of course, were introduced by Labour. This isn't just a Ken Clark story. And some of those things may have had an effect. And alongside of that, you need to think about the rather more contingent effects of the riot sentencing. A whole load of young people in particular going into the prison system for a relatively short period in the first quarter of this year, and now they're coming out. And I think there's probably going to be a mix of things ultimately behind what's going on.
On what happens next, I mean, Polly says, you know, when top politicians in particular start to talk tough on crime, magistrates have tended to respond. I'm just thinking, if this 9 a day goes into reverse, we are going to hit the buffers, aren't we? Because part of Ken Clark's argument was very much, we don't have the money to build the extra places that current policies would require. Do you think we'll just get to a point where there are, you know, emergency releases and things in a few years' time?
I think not. I mean, you know, there is still a prison building programme going on, or a capacity expanding programme going on. And there is actually now a reasonable gap between how many are in prison and what the absolute break point is. And there's always other things that you can do. Operation Safeguard, you can start putting people in police cells. There's a number of things. You can change the regime around tagging in a very, you know, very small ways, which can have quite a big impact. So I think there's quite a lot of wriggle room there. But I think what we're also seeing is a degree of smoke and mirrors. last June, this is June 2011, the Prime Minister made an important press conference announcement where he effectively said, we are going to provide the prison places that are needed in the future, and we are not going to try and reduce the prison population by changing sentencing. Now, of course, what they've actually done in practice is to introduce some sentencing changes that may have a long-term impact. But I think in the grander scheme of things, it's at the moment the prison population is a very manageable situation. But of course, we're only talking here about England and Wales. Scotland and Northern Ireland have different regimes, different systems in place. The only region of the United Kingdom that's actually seen a rising prison population since the beginning of the year is Northern Ireland. And again, I think those are to do with some distinctive factors in Northern Ireland. So the overall picture is quite complicated.
Okay, let's just turn now to the economy. Figures that have just come out in the last hour or so, around 20 minutes ago, say that the economy has grown by a zippy 1 percentage point, which that's just in the one quarter, the third quarter of the year. I'll just turn now to Larry Elliott, who we spoke to earlier, who's got his explanation on where that figure came from.
What these figures show is that the economy has finally emerged from its double-dip recession. The UK contracted between late 2011 and the middle of 2012. These figures are for growth in the third quarter of 2012. They show the economy expanding by 1%. That means we're out of recession. The figures are a bit better than expected, but the 1% growth in the third quarter has to be looked at in the round. 0.5% of that, so 0.5 points of the 1%, was just the result of production being made up after the extra bank holiday in the second quarter. So there was a sort of arithmetic effect. So there was much less growth in the second quarter because we all had an extra day off to celebrate the Queen's Jubilee. So that was made up in the third quarter. And another special factor was the Olympics. So all the ticket sales for the Olympics counted in the third quarter growth figures, even though quite a lot of them took place over the previous 12 months, but they were all counted in that period. So that added another 0.2 points. So of the 1% growth, probably around 0.7 was the result of special factors. During this period, we've had some good quarters of growth before, which have always proved to be false dawns. So I think the government will be pleased, but they'll be cautious about these numbers. I think more interesting, I suppose, is what the Bank of England does, because there has been some speculation that the Bank of England will loosen policy again next month, that they will actually try and pump some more money into the economy. I think that looks now very much in the balance after these strong growth figures. I think that the Bank of England may well sit tight as a result of this. They could quite easily go in the other direction in the fourth quarter. Most of the forward-looking indicators are not that strong. The Eurozone crisis is still rumbling on. Credit is still hard to come by. The housing market's still flat. So George Osborne was saying this morning in his comments, he's obviously very pleased by the numbers, but he doesn't say at the moment that the economy is out of the woods, and it isn't. One of the big problems with the economy the last few years is that prices have been going up much faster than wages, and that's meant that people's money has been going less far than it used to, and that with inflation coming down, I think people's money will stretch a little bit further. So people, I think, probably will start to feel just a little bit better off than they did this time last year.
So Larry there, Polly, telling us that the detail of some of that 1% means that we shouldn't get carried away. We're not really going at an annualised rate of 4%, which is probably where we should be after such a big recession, but something more modest. But nonetheless, it's a big political moment, isn't it? The fact that George Osborne can say we're out of the double dip and we're growing and we're back in business.
Yes, it is a big political moment. And they're being quite wise in not actually bouncing up and down too much, because it's quite likely that the next quarter won't be 1%. It could even fall back again. You never know. And so they are being cautious. And so, you know, it's not good, because the OBR said we should have been growing massively by now. The prediction was we should have been growing by over 3% at this stage. The annual rate's not going to look very good. You know, the employment situation is peculiar in that many more people are in work than you would expect after such a deep recession, but they're in rotten work, they're in part-time work, they're not earning enough money. The welfare bills are rising because credits from the taxpayer have to fill the gap in people's wages. People just aren't earning enough and they're feeling the pinch. And we had figures from the ONS this week showing just how squeezed Middle Britain feels, or, you know, middle to bottom Britain. 13% squeeze is pretty hard on budgets because of price rises, inflation rises, and the lack of any pay increases.
So don't call time on hard times just yet. Randy, this is a rather nerdy point, but maybe an important one. David Cameron appeared to give away the figure in the House of Commons yesterday, saying, oh, we're about to get some very good news. Does that make you cross that he can see these figures and give advance trails about it beforehand?
I think it probably depends whether he actually saw the information or whether he just had a good feeling in his stomach, which is hard to divine unless you're in his stomach. I mean, these things happen in politics. People say it's market-sensitive information. The market forecast for about 0.6-0.5% growth. He wasn't telling anybody anything about the scale of the growth, so I think he's left off the hook there. I think the big problem for the government is that, as some commentators have already identified, it's growth in big finance and growth in big government, if you like, that's seen the bounce, which, you know, Britain isn't building again. That's a big problem for them. The construction sector contracted, although we did see industrial output up. So there's some glimmers of hope for the government, but it's probably not the kind of growth they, I suspect, want.
Although they might be happy with any just now, just in terms of bringing some money into the coffers. But Richard, you were saying before it's complicated. You know, I think 5 or 10 years ago, people thought if a really big recession hit, overall acquisitive crime would go up in a way that we haven't seen in this recession. I think the Home Office published stuff predicting we'd be in trouble by now, and we're not. But presumably that means you can't be confident that if the economy picks up, you can't tell which way it will go up when the economy picks back up either.
Well, one of the most striking pieces of research in the last 10 years or so was done by Danny Dorling, an old friend of The Guardian. And Danny looked at homicide rates through a 20-year period from the late 70s to the late 90s. So during the period of quite significant recessions. And he found some very striking correlations between vulnerability to homicide, so victimisation, not people's propensity to commit homicide, but victimisation, and those who'd been affected by the recession, particularly young people who had a much elevated risk of homicide victimisation. Now, there are no straight line correlations in this business, so we can't assume that the current recession is going to have a similar impact. But we do know that young people in particular are being profoundly affected by this recession. I think that's going to be a legacy of this recession for many years to come. I think we are likely to see it, for example, in elevated suicide rates, which is one of the things that we have seen, and possibly in homicide rates and other things. This is a very serious matter. It's clearly a good thing. If the economy is starting to grow again, that's a good thing. I don't think anyone's going to say it's a bad thing. But nonetheless, there are some very significant problems that have been stored up, which are going to play out over a number of years to come. So that may be also why the Treasury is being cautious. They don't want to kind of wave the flag too quickly.
What's odd about it is we've got more NEETs and we've got more long-term young unemployed, and these are the crimogenic groups. These are the people who commit most crimes, and yet they don't appear to be. You know, they're putting up with it. They're not rebelling, perhaps as they ought to.
Although, of course, well, you know, we saw enormous riots, last summer. I mean, I think there are some interesting questions. I mean, at a kind of an academic level about changes in particular crime patterns. You know, why, for example, has acquisitive crime, particularly burglaries, fallen? Is it because we're just much better at securing our homes than in the past? Or we're just, you know, we're more aware of making sure we close our windows before we go out? Is it because actually, frankly, breaking into most houses these days, you know, the pickings are fairly slim. You can steal a great big plasma screen TV and you're likely to get stopped by the police. Or if you're lucky, you might sell it for £20 in the black market. Well, compared with our iPhones, our iPods and all sorts of other things which are available to be stolen on our person. You know, there may be all sorts of reasons why some forms of acquisitive crime are not as prominent as they once were, and the same probably also with car crime.
I mean, I was away for a good part of the last decade, and when I came back, what really struck me about Britain was the CCTVs had really penetrated, and I saw that with the riots as well, in a way that I really didn't imagine. I mean, you really are watched on the streets in a way that I didn't think so when I left the country in 2002-03, went away for, you know, basically all the way up to 2010. There was a significant change in the surveillance nature of the state and what it could see and what it couldn't and what it recorded.
Does it stop people? Do people remember? What's often interesting about crime and CCTV is you think these idiots haven't realised, they haven't clocked that they're being watched. But does it stop people?
Well, there was some research done some years ago which suggested that CCTV in car parks had an effect. That, you know, if you're thinking about it, if you're planning to steal a car, it requires a certain amount of calculation in advance and planning. And if you know there is a car park with good CCTV cameras, you're going to think, well, I'm kind of trying to break in, I'm going to get caught on camera. So you go around the dark alleyway around the back where it's not covered. The research also suggested there was very little notable impact just in city centres per se on the kinds of behaviours. And again, you know, particularly if you're thinking about, you know, punch-ups on a Friday night after the pub, well, generally speaking, people aren't necessarily going out for the pub at night with the intention of having a big punch-up afterwards. You know, they're drunk, they get into an argument and they get into a fight. And those things are often much more impulsive. And, you know, at best in that sense, CCTV may be able to, you know, pick up the effect afterwards and maybe pick up the suspects afterwards. And we saw that, I think, particularly in the riots, where it was very clear that one of the things that was going on there was that the police were going through hours and hours of CCTV and thinking, oh, I recognise him. Oh, yeah, I know who she is. You know, and they were going out and picking them up. Well, there are probably lots of people who weren't known to the police who were also involved in those kinds of things who were never picked up because no one recognised them.
Now, the nearest thing that Westminster has to a gangland culture is probably the party whip's office. This week sees Sir George Young return to the whips after nearly 40 years after his first stint under Margaret Thatcher, who was still in opposition in the 1970s. This week, I caught up with the playwright James Graham, whose play This House, set in the whips office of the 1970s, and I asked him about the dramatic potential of these curious Westminster creatures. So, first of all, James, you've done the unusual thing of taking these backroom boys, the whips, boys and girls, and bringing them front of stage in your play. But I bet you never saw a whip make a splash quite like Andrew Mitchell did before.
I know, it's incredible, isn't it? That happened when we were in previews and none of us could really believe it. Obviously, the point of a whip, or a good, effective whip, is to never end up on the front page of a national newspaper. So it was, the resonance or just the bringing into the public eye of what the whip's role is was really quite incredible. But yeah, the choice to look at the whips rather than the big names of that period, or to be in Downing Street or to be in Whitehall, was because in a hung parliament, when you literally don't have enough members on your side to pass laws, all the drama just happens in Westminster, and particularly in the whips office. It's all about human resources and handling people and personalities and problems, and that's the basis of all good drama. So it seemed actually like a bit of a no-brainer.
You know, you've obviously studied it, you've talked to a large number of the participants who were still breathing, although of course Walter keeled over this week, didn't he? But
very sad, yeah.
And he helped you with the play, did he, Walt Harrison?
He did, yeah. Well, he read a couple of the early drafts, and I had the great pleasure of going up and having an afternoon with him in his house in Wakefield, surrounded by the most amazing photos and, you know, boxes and boxes of letters and brilliant memorabilia from the past. So it was great, and he was really generous with his time, and even just spending an afternoon with him, I could see the two sides of why he was known to be the best deputy whip of all time. I could see the bruiser and the steely-eyed glare, whilst also that real warmth and generosity which you also need to be as a whip, which I don't think is perhaps publicised quite as much as it probably should be.
So you think it's, in terms of how you do the job, you think it's a real mixture of what being a bruiser and being charming?
Completely, yeah. You've got to be the tough guy that people are scared of, or girl, and, you know, make sure people are on edge enough or scared enough to toe the party line. But also, you know, if you're having troubles in your marriage, if your finances are in difficulty, if you're having trouble in your constituency, often would be that office where they will be able to either offer a shoulder to cry on or whatever. I mean, obviously every different whip has their own distinct style and personality. Ted Heath famously started in the whip's office, and I'm sure his style was completely different to Walt Harrison's, and Walt is very different to Andrew Mitchell's. But it's it's just that funny, slightly bipolar, schizophrenic nature of the job, in that they have to be both quite scared of you and also they need to be able to come to you in your times of absolute crisis.
And another thing you wouldn't have seen coming when you set off on the play is that George Young, who was a whip during your period, just about, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Would emerge and bicycle back to the chief whip's office in 2012.
I know, incredible. It's I got to speak to George, actually, because he was a junior minister in the 74-79 Parliament on the Tory side, And actually, the people on the Tory side were a little bit more sparse to get hold of than Labour. So I was really grateful to speak to George, and he invited me into his the most amazing office in Westminster, which is the leader of the House's office. And yeah, we had a good old chat. And he had lots of fond memories at the time. And actually, he introduced me to some anecdotes and stories I'd never heard of actually, which made it into the play. So yeah, it's very weird how it all comes full circle. And he's now back in the office, 40 years later. It's incredible.
And where do you think he'd sit on the charm versus bruiser scale?
God, good question. I mean, I only spend an hour with him, Tots, but I think he seemed very warm and very kind and very smiley and quite relaxed. But I guess, like all of them, they can turn like that. And I'd imagine you still probably wouldn't want to push the boundaries too far with George.
Now, you had what looked to me like a fantastic scoop, which is something you don't expect when you go to the theatre, about Bernard Jack Wetherill, who went later on to be Speaker, and the suggestion that he had offered to forego the chance to bring down the government in 1979, but that the Labour side were too gentlemanly to accept it. Was that your scoop, and were you the first to bring it to light?
Yes and no, I think. They got revealed, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago, so it's still quite new. It was Jack Wetherill, just before he passed away, who announced this in an interview, and then Walter confirmed it. But for whatever reason, it hasn't seemed to emanate out into the public sphere very much. And I just thought it was so incredible and so moving when I heard that. It's, you know, the general narrative of modern British politics is it's completely oppositional and it's aggressive, and people don't share those kinds of moments across party lines. So to be honest, when I found out, and that was quite early on in the writing process, I knew somehow that would form that relationship between a very traditional trade unionist Labour working class whip and a more conventional one nation Tory. I thought that would be the spine of the play, if you like. That would lead up to this incredible moment at the end of the play, where one side offers to sacrifice himself to save the other, and that offer's turned down. And it's a real, for me, I just think it's important to hear those stories and to know that in amongst a very complicated and often very rough world of bad faith, that sometimes great moments and gestures of decency and honour can still exist.
Fantastic. And last of all, I was going to ask, a lot of Guardian readers inclined to think that the whips are a bad thing and they should be done away with, you know, that everyone should vote with their conscience on everything, as Audrey Wise is inclined to do in your play. But having thought about and scrutinised the role of the whips, I mean, do you come away thinking for the most part they're an important institution, or are they one that you two would want to get rid of?
It's, I mean, both. On paper, it does seem the most undemocratic and monstrous of things to have this machine whereby, in contrary to constituents voting and members to go and speak on their behalf and represent their issues in Parliament, regardless of party lines, we have these men and women whose job it is to just force you and everyone in your party to go in one direction, whether it's the benefits of your constituents or not. So, of course, part of me shivers and thinks that can't be right. And yet, there is an argument, and it is a good one, I think, that in order to get anything done as a body of, 600 people, so possibly around 300 of those are on the government side, in order to pass anything that's positive and good, possibly each individual member has to compromise a little bit on something in order to get something that roughly everyone's vaguely in favour of on the statute book. And in order to do that, maybe you need these very strange bunch of people to kind of marshal that through the House. So I, just because it's useful as a dramatist as well, I like to play devil's advocate a little bit and say that possibly nothing would get done if it was just 600 odd individual members trying to pursue 600 individual causes, and maybe that would turn out to be completely ineffective and worse than what we have now.
Finally this week, when Dominic Grieve made the decision that letters from Prince Charles to various government ministers should remain secret, he dealt a huge blow to Freedom of Information campaigners and Republicans alike. This week, he explained that the heir to the throne had a right to raise queries or points with ministers. Now, Randeep, as I understand it, the rationale for this decision was something about protecting the heir to the throne's preparation for the kingship, which is a rather medieval kind of sounding phrase, isn't it?
I suppose it's a sort of job training scheme, isn't it? You have a safe space to learn how to be a monarch.
For 64 years, or whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, I I mean, while this the issue, I don't think, of republicanism has much sort of salience with the British people, that may be a good or bad thing. I think the idea that Charles is somehow learning what to do on the job, aged whatever, seems ridiculous. I mean, and to be honest, it sort of implies that as a king, he would be doing something like this. I mean, if he's testing his boundaries now, then he knows where they lie in the future, and who knows what he'll be saying to ministers. It's curious because we don't really know what the Queen says to ministers at the moment. So I think, to me, it's
until Frank Gardner tells us.
Until Frank tells us, and then he gets sort of excommunicated from the BBC, you know, for doing so. I find it just a really odd and strange bit of the ornamental monarchy that isn't ornamental. I mean, that's what really this shows. There is something, apart from the showpiece value of monarchy in the British constitutional setup, that we don't really understand and we don't really know, and it always strikes me as odd. And, you know, I find it just a relic of some old past. Maybe I'm being sort of bad, doing down our own history, but...
Well, everyone's nodding, I think. But Polly, Dominic Grieve, Attorney General, very fair-minded sort of fellow, and made a big show of having consulted everyone. I think Ed Miliband and the Liberals as well, about what approach to take on this one. An establishment stitch-up?
Yes, it smells that way, doesn't it? I mean, it seems extraordinary that he should be allowed to write these letters. I mean, does the Queen write letters, or does she just speak when she meets people, when she meets the Prime Minister? Perhaps she just has a word in his ear and she doesn't need to actually write anything down in spidery writing. We don't know what her writing looks like. I think it is very odd, and I think he should be stopped from doing it. And if it were public, he would be stopped from doing it. We don't know what impact he's had, and maybe on some particular issues he really has had, and we could trace it if we could see what the letter said and what happened afterwards. Maybe that's why both parties are not keen to have that back, because maybe Labour bent. You know, we know politicians get scared, and we know the monarchy is very popular, and maybe ministers did, Labour and Conservative, bend to the spidery letters.
Any thoughts on what would happen if some politician stood up and said, well, Charles, shut up or stand down?
Well, I think the interesting thing about this as well is, I mean, Dominic Grieve's been in the news this week on something else to do with prisoner voting. And, of course, one thing that Prince Charles and prisoners have in common is none of them are allowed to vote. And so at one level, you could say, well, you know, he doesn't have a chance to vote and decide on the government of the country. So maybe he ought to be able to write the odd letter and fire off something and give his view. But, you know, he remains, of course, the potential head of state. And, you know, I mean, I'm a Republican myself. I've met Prince Charles. He strikes me as a perfectly nice chap. You know, I bear him no malice. But, you know, whether in the 21st century we should have someone as a head of state who's simply born to the job is another matter. Now, ultimately, you know, he's writing these letters. Well, either the letters have a potential influence on ministers, in which case we as the voters ought to be able to see them, or they don't have an influence, in which case why is he wasting time writing them at all?
The very pithy way of putting it, Richard. Seeing as you're here, we should just get your mind on the prisoners voting question. For the uninitiated, this is a decision that goes back a number of years, when the European Court of Human Rights said that the blanket ban that the UK operates on prisoners voting is not lawful. And we got a story this week that maybe the government was going to bring forward a draft bill to kind of draw this one out for another few years, and then we got a denial of even that. What do you think's actually going on?
Oh, goodness knows. I mean, they're in a bit of a hole on this. The European Court has made it very clear that they have to do something. The Prime Minister is clearly in a difficult position, having put himself on record in the past as being opposed. I suspect some form of mucky compromise over time is going to have to be found.
But do they need a legislation to do that?
Yeah, I think my understanding is they do. I mean, I'm on record as saying actually all prisoners ought to have the vote. You know, the only reason why people shouldn't have the vote is if there are clear medical reasons why they aren't in a position to exercise reasoned consent.
That's an awful
consent.
Lot of them.
Well, no, that may well be the case. But and in that case, that should be the basis for excluding people, you know, on age or because of mental incapacity, not simply because they're in prison. I mean, they're in prison as a punishment. They're not in prison for
Don't
punishment.
Don't you find it very odd, though, of all of the things that the European Court of Human Rights should get worried about prisoners? You look at the awful lives of prisoners. You look at a lot of them being banged up for 23 hours a day. A lot of them are mental cases. You shouldn't be in there at all. You know, desperate stories. And the one thing they're going to be offered is a vote. I mean, look at the numbers of people who don't vote when they're absent, when they're out and free to. You say to a prisoner, what do you really need? Do you think they say, what I really need to put me on a path of righteousness is the vote?
Although it wasn't their fault, was it? I mean, the case was brought, they had to hear it. And I mean, the two things, the government's just kicking this into the long grass. I think the draft bill strategy sounds perfectly plausible to me. It means that they can get it into the run-up to the election, which means it's politically, we don't need to deal with it, and the next administration can. And plus, I mean, the last judgment, I think, in Austria on this issue actually did come out with a statement which said, well, unless your conviction is related to disenfranchisement, I don't see why you shouldn't have the vote. Well, we enshrine the European Human Rights Act. The Council of Europe is now monitoring people's adherence to it. It seems that the government, I think even the government last year, told the Telegraph that we were going to put this law into action. We had to.
But
I kind of see that they've got nowhere to go on this.
It's a mini constitutional crisis, though, isn't it? Because we're all signed up. Even the Conservatives say they want to rip up the Human Rights Act, but they're determined to remain within the European Convention on Human Rights. And then its court is in Strasbourg and says, no, you've got to change something. And that Parliament, both sides of Parliament, Jack Straw as much as David Davis, say they're not going to do anything about it. And so, you know, it can roll down the road. But at some point, either it becomes obvious that what the European Court says doesn't happen, or we have to do something and there's a big fuss.
I think Dominic Grieve was rather brave this week, and he said straight out to his party, we have to do this. They say we must. There are no two ways about it. There's something that the, you know, Europhobic right will just have to accept. And I thought Grieve was acting very properly in his formal role. But, you know, whether it actually happens, of course, is another matter. It'll be a big test for the Lib Dems, because this is something, you know, this is the final last saloon for the Lib Dems, holding on to their belief in human rights.
Well, let's hope that Prince Charles writes them a letter and then they can sort it all out. But for the moment, that's all for this week. If you still haven't had enough, you can catch up with our US election podcast special, which was recorded earlier in the week. With 2 weeks to go until polling day, the race there could hardly be tighter. But for now, my thanks to Polly Toynbee, to Richard Garside and to Randeep Ramesh. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark. We're back next week as normal, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.